So the topic of this lecture is dividend policy. We're going to be carrying on with the model of Modigliani Miller that we learned last week in capital structure, except now when we talk about dividend policy, we refer to a different paper that they published in 1961, and I presume to avoid a major bust-up, they switched their names around. So whenever we talk about the dividend policy paper, we refer to it as Miller Modigliani, because that's the order in which the authors listed their name. Now, our approach in this lecture is going to be very similar to how we started with the capital structure story. Basically, I want to start by posing a question. Does dividend policy matter? If it does matter, then the senior managers of the company should be spending some time thinking about what is the optimal dividend policy. If it doesn't matter, then they shouldn't be spending any time at all thinking about dividend policy. Now, we asked ourselves the same sort of question in the context of capital structure. And the way we're going to go about this is similar to how we did it last week with capital structure. First, we're going to look at some empirical evidence to see what happens in the real world. Then we're going to take a step back from the real world and revisit the perfect world of Modigliani Miller, Miller Modigliani. And then we're going to ask ourselves, what are the key differences between the perfect world of M&M, as I call them for short, and the real world? And the reason we want to highlight those key differences is, as we'll see, and as you've probably anticipated, in the perfect world of M&M, dividend policy is irrelevant. Just as we found last week that capital structure is irrelevant in the perfect world of M&M, we're going to find in this lecture that so is dividend policy. But the empirical evidence from the real world suggests that's not the case. It suggests that dividend policy does matter in the real world. So we want to understand, what are the key differences between the real world and the M&M perfect world that make dividend policy relevant in the real world, but not in the perfect world? Because those key differences provide clues to the senior managers of the company as to how they should go about finding the optimum dividend policy for their company. That's the logic. So let's start with looking at the real world. Let's look at some empirical data. I hesitate to tell you this because you may immediately dismiss it as being hideously out of date. The original study that informs the points that are on this slide was carried out by a man called James Lintner in the US. Now, we're not going to look in detail at the so-called Lintner model of dividend policy. I'll just give you the bare bones. I'll spare you the mathematical detail. But you might be switched off immediately when I tell you that Lintner published his paper on dividend policy in the year I was born. So that's 55 years ago. So you might be wondering, why are we spending time learning about Lintner? Is the man really that sentimental about his birth? Well, absolutely not. There are findings in Lintner's study that still hold true today, we think. So although the story has moved on and we have more sophisticated ways of thinking about things, nonetheless, it's useful to go back to this early study of James Lintner in 1956, which was set in the US and is based on the results of interviews with the senior managers of a large number of US companies. So the empirical observations that Lintner is talking about are what he learns from visiting the headquarters of the major US companies and interviewing their senior people about their dividend policy. He's looking for clues. He's looking for patterns. Are there similarities? And what he takes out of his survey are the following key points. We believe that those key points still hold true by and large today. with some qualifications to that. The story I want to sell to you then today is the following. That companies that pay dividends to their shareholders aim to have a stable policy regarding dividends. Now, it's very important that you understand it's the policy that's stable, not the size of the dividend per share. Because the policy that I have in mind is one in which the dividend per share grows through time. So what companies with shareholders, companies that have established a pattern of paying dividends to their shareholders, what they appear to practice is a policy in which they attempt to grow the dividends per share through time at a rate that is sustainable. That's important. They don't want to push up the size of the dividends per share too much, too quickly, only then to have to cut back later on. Because cutting back later on sends a negative signal to the shareholders and indeed to the market as a whole. So it's all about steady as we go. We want to push up the size of the dividend per share, but at a rate that we, the senior managers, feel confident on the basis of what we know and believe about the company's future prospects, at a rate that we feel confident we can sustain. So moderate, sustainable growth over the long term, that's what Lindner extracted as part of the key dividend policy. What you need to understand is the size of the dividend per share is within the control of the senior managers. That's a main board decision. It's a strategic decision. How much of our surplus earnings should we distribute to the shareholders in the form of dividends, as opposed to retaining within the company for investment in positive NPV projects? This is a long-term strategic decision, because money that's paid out in the form of dividends has gone. It's no longer within the company for investment in long-term capital projects. So this is a key decision, and the shareholders of the company have delegated that decision-making to the senior managers, to the main board. So the size of the dividend is, to a large extent, within the control of the senior managers. But the feedstock of the dividend, that's the earnings, the surplus earnings, is not within the control of the senior managers. How much surplus cash flow there is, once we've paid all the interest to the lenders, once we've paid our corporation tax bill, how much surplus cash flow remains depends in part on the state of the economy. How good is business? When business is booming because the economy is growing, then there's plenty of surplus cash flow. When times are tough, there isn't nearly as much cash flow. Indeed, there may not be any to finance the payment of dividends. So the feedstock, the earnings per share, is not within the control of the managers. It's the dividends per share that they decide to pay using that surplus earnings. That's what they can control. So have at the back of your mind that the earnings per share, which largely govern what the company can do, these are volatile. These are subject to market fluctuations. They go up and down. Now, it's a call on the judgment and the skill of the senior managers to manage that volatility. Because as I've said a moment or two ago, what the companies aim to do is operate a stable dividend policy in which they grow the dividend per share at a rate they feel confident of sustaining. What Lindner's findings suggest are the following. That the senior managers have in mind a long-term target payout ratio. Now, the payout ratio is the ratio of the dividend per share to the earnings per share. This is something we'll revisit in a later lecture when we look at share valuation. So they have in mind a long-run payout ratio that they aspire to. They want to get the payout ratio up to that target value in the long run. They don't get up there straight away. They're going to approach the long run target payout ratio gradually. They're going to do it in a series of steps over the long term, and they're going to take, to the best of their ability, they're going to ensure that the size of the steps they take are not so big that subsequently they have to cut back. So they want to approach the long run target ratio in a series of steps, but it's always upwards, a little bit further upwards. And the empirical evidence now, this is risky for me to say this, because if you leave this lecture thinking, ah, he said it's definitely the case that blah blah, you're missing the point. This is a broad brush remark. It's a, on average, it's a ballpark figure. I'm not saying any one company does exactly this. But it doesn't hurt us as we try to come up with this general picture. It doesn't hurt us if we think of the target payout ratio as being one half. In other words, over the long run, it would appear that companies have in mind paying out roughly one half of their surplus earnings per share in the form of dividends per share. So that's where they're headed in the long run. They're not there yet. There's a gap. And the empirical evidence suggests that the way the companies go about closing the gap in a series of steps is each year they narrow the gap by one-third. One-third. Whatever the gap is at the beginning of the year, they aim to increase the payout ratio in order to close the size of that gap by one-third. Now, I am not saying that any company does exactly this. I'm saying that when you look at companies, these were US companies, in the round, and you try to extract some general behaviour, we're not that far from the story. If we think of the long-run target payout ratio being one-half, so one-half of earnings per share being distributed as dividends per share, and that the speed of approach to that long-run payout ratio, target payout ratio, is to reduce the gap between where the target payout ratio is and where we currently are with the payout ratio, reduce that gap by one-third each year. And there's a question on the seminar sheet for next week on dividend policy that gives you an opportunity to crunch some numbers to see how that might work out. It's a model. It's an attempt to simplify what appears to be going on in the real world. And what I want you to understand is, it is only a model. So why might what we observe be different from that? And in this context, the key variable is the volatility of the firm's earnings. The more volatile are those earnings, I would suggest to you, the lower is the long-term payout ratio. The more volatile are the earnings, I would suggest to you, the slower is the speed of approach. Because at the end of the day, the company senior managers have to worry about the possibility that in any one year things might not be going too well. And the last thing they want to do is inform their shareholders we're having to cut the size of the dividend per share. Because that sends a very negative signal to the shareholders and the market as a whole. It suggests the people running this company don't know what they're doing. So the speed of approach is a conservative one, at a rate that the company feels confident it can sustain when the feedstock, when the earnings per share, which are used to pay to fund the dividends per share, when the earnings per share are exhibiting higher volatility, that means they can be quite large in the very good times, but worryingly low in the bad times. I'm suggesting to you that such a company will set its long-term target payout ratio lower than one half, and it will approach that long-run target payout ratio more slowly than cutting the gap by one-third. And you can see whether that's true by looking at some of the empirical data. So that's the real world. A stable dividend policy, a long-run payout ratio that the company gradually aspires to. Steady as she goes. So now we're going to take a step back from the real world. We're going to go back into the perfect world of our two new friends, Franco Modigliani and Merton Miller.
brackets, deceased, the latter. Modigliani's still going strong, but Miller died a few years ago. Both Nobel Prize winners. But they didn't both get their Nobel Prize for this work. Miller got it for this work, but Modigliani got it for something else. Okay. Do you remember what the perfect world looks like? I haven't told you the full story. You have to wait until Finance 2 for the full story of the M&M perfect world. I've given you four key characteristics. These are the only four I want you to know. If you know more because you've read further, that's just fine. If you want to show off in any answer to an exam question I might ask by listing more than four, that's just fine. Just make sure what the other ones are you list are also correct. The four I need you to know are the following. In an M&M perfect world, there are no taxes. In an M&M perfect world, there are no transactions costs. In particular, there are no issue costs associated with raising fresh external capital. In an M&M perfect world, everyone has the same information set, regardless of whether they're on the inside of the company or on the outside. In other words, there is no private information in an M&M perfect world. And we have a fancy phrase for that. We say there's no information asymmetry. Asymmetry means lack of symmetry. Well, there's perfect symmetry as far as information is concerned in an M&M perfect world. And finally, the financial markets are perfectly efficient. Perfectly efficient at impounding new relevant information in their prices. You need to know those four key characteristics. I have in the past asked as part of an exam question, list four key characteristics of an M&M perfect world. So we're in such a world, but now our focus is on dividends. In the last two lectures on capital structure, and again today in this lecture on dividend policy, our attention is focused on the sources of financing, not the uses of financing. So we freeze out the uses. In other words, we have settled on what are the uses of the financing. In other words, the company has decided which assets it should buy and what to do with those assets, i.e. which capital projects to invest in. So we assume that the capital investment policy is fixed. Nothing is changing on the assets side of the story. Nothing is changing on the uses of financing side of the story. That's fixed. What we were exploring in last week's lectures on capital structure was the consequences, if any, of changing the sources of financing. Now the question we want to explore is, does it matter if we change the amount that's paid out as dividends? Is dividend policy relevant or not? And as in last week's lecture, relevant means, does it have any impact on the value of the firm? Now you can anticipate the answer from what we learned last week in capital structure. In an M&M perfect world, just as capital structure didn't matter, it's irrelevant, so will dividend policy prove to be. Because as in last week's lectures, all that matters in an M&M perfect world is the capital investment policy. In other words, what assets does the firm have and what does it do with those assets? And we're assuming that's fixed. That's already been decided and that's not changing. So we anticipate the value of the firm won't change. In an M&M perfect world, regardless of whether we alter the capital structure, that was last week's story, or as we're now about to see, regardless of what we do concerning the dividend policy. So let's have a cartoon. The box, as you might by now be getting used to, the box represents the firm, the firm's assets. The size of the box is the market value of the firm's assets. On the left-hand side of the diagram are the sources of funding. And you might want to note down what each of the two are, because you should be asking yourself, why doesn't he just draw a single arrow coming in on the left? And the answer is, because he wants to distinguish between internal funding and external funding. The internal source of financing, I've labelled that C C stands for cash flow, the internal source of financing. You know from the first lecture on company financing, that's the retained earnings of the company. That's its own internal funds. External funding, well, I've used C for cash flow. I would like to have used it for capital, but I can't. So the next best thing I can think of is the symbol K. So external funding is represented by K. That's financing that the company is raising from outside. It could be in the form of debt, or it could be in the form of equity. But it doesn't matter in an M&M perfect world, because capital structure is irrelevant. So I'm not going to waste any time reminding myself whether big K is external financing in the form of debt or equity. It doesn't matter. So to keep the story as straightforward as possible, I'm going to assume it's equity. I've no need for debt in this story. I'm not going to learn anything new in an M&M perfect world, because capital structure is irrelevant. So you might like to note down that without loss of any generality, I'm assuming the firm is all equity financed. So any additional capital it raises from outside will be in the form of equity. I don't lose any generality by assuming that. I don't lose any generality by neglecting to consider debt, so long as I'm in an M&M perfect world. So the first of the two arrows coming in on the left represent internal financing, retained earnings by another name. The second of the two arrows represents fresh external financing, which I'm going to assume is in the form of equity. On the right-hand side are the possible uses of the financing. And there are two, which is why there are two arrows. Some of the cash flow can be invested in capital projects, so that's big I for investment, with the balance being paid out, distributed to the shareholders as dividends. Actually, it doesn't have to be dividends. It could be what we call a share buyback. And there's a question on the seminar sheet next week about share buyback, and that's your opportunity to learn a little bit about share buyback, or as they call it in the US, stock repurchase. I'm going to think of D as a cash dividend payment, but it doesn't have to be. A regular dividend is not the only way of returning cash to shareholders. From time to time, companies can buy back some of the existing shares in return for cash. And there are any number of reasons why the company might want to do that, and that's what one of the questions on the seminar for next week is inviting you to find out. Do a Google search or look up the textbook, see what you can learn about share buyback or stock repurchase, and that will help you to understand something about that. You'll learn more about share buybacks in finance too. But it would be useful if you note down on your notes that D needn't be a dividend. I'll think of it as a dividend. It's a distribution of cash to the shareholders. Now, here's the punchline. In an M&M perfect world, all that matters regarding the value of the firm, i.e. the size of the box, are the assets of the firm and what the company does with those assets. And as I've already said, that's fixed. The capital investment policy is fixed. Therefore, the size of the box doesn't change. The students have no difficulty in understanding, because of that, what comes in on the left must equal what goes out on the right. Because if that wasn't true, the size of the box would change. And that's absolutely correct. But we can say more, and we should say more, because we should also be reminding ourselves about the assumptions that we make in an M&M perfect world. For example, no transactions costs, and in particular, no issue costs. So, whenever the company looks outside of itself to raise fresh capital, none of the financing it raises is consumed as issue costs. All of this K feeds into the company. That's not true in the real world. In the real world, some of the financing that's raised ends up in the pockets of third parties like brokers and advisors. But we have none of them in an M&M perfect world. There are no issue costs. So all of the capital that's raised from outside does indeed feed into the company. On the other side of the story, in the real world, shareholders who receive dividends, that's a form of income, they pay tax on that. They pay income tax on their dividends. If the company has a share buyback, so it's buying back some of its existing shares, is it buying it back at the market price? Is it buying it back at some other price? If the shareholders who surrender some of their shares as part of the share buyback do so for a price that's considerably larger than what they paid for the shares in the first place, that's a capital gain. And if that capital gain exceeds the capital gains tax threshold, the shareholders have to pay capital gains tax. So there are two possible forms of tax associated with that term D in the real world, not in the M&M perfect world. In the M&M perfect world, all of the cash that's destined for the shareholders ends up in the pockets of the shareholders, because there is no third party called the tax man in the story. And it's important that you understand that. Because of all of that, the value of the firm depends only on its assets, its capital investment policy, so the box doesn't change size. All of the capital coming in on the left feeds into the box. All of the cash flow going out on the right ends up where it's meant to be. Because of that, we can write down an identity. And the identity says, and you should write this down, C plus K equals D plus I. The cartoon is saying it as a picture. You'll have an opportunity in one of the questions in next week's seminar to use that identity to crunch some numbers and to make some conclusions. So C plus K equals D plus I. What comes in on the left must emerge on the right. But we can go further. We're assuming a fixed capital investment policy. So big I is fixed. The company has decided on the capital projects in which it wishes to invest. So it knows the individual investments for each of those projects, and therefore it knows the aggregate investment, which is what big I represents. But it's already decided on those projects, so it knows the cash flows out into the future. It knows the NPVs, so it knows how much cash flow is being generated. With a fixed capital investment policy, not only is big I fixed, but so is big C fixed. Because big C depends on big I. Big C is generated from the projects that the company is going to be investing in. If we're not changing the capital investment policy, we're not just freezing big I, we're also freezing big C. So in this diagram, the only numbers that can change are big K on the left, that's fresh capital from outside, and big D on the right, that's cash paid out as dividends or possibly used to buy back shares. Now let's go back to the question that I asked at the beginning of the lecture. Does dividend policy matter? Does it matter in an M&M perfect world if the company changes the amount it pays out as dividends? And now I can see the answer is no, because I see from my cartoon that the only way that the company can increase the size of the dividend is to raise additional capital from outside in the first place. The extra fresh capital that it raises outside of itself simply feeds through the company and reappears on the other side as an enhanced dividend. It's just a throughput. Raising the amount to be paid as dividends doesn't alter the size of the box in an M&M perfect world, because the size of the box is determined by the assets of the firm and what the company does with them. So in an M&M perfect world, dividend policy is irrelevant. If the company chooses to pay a dividend, that is simply a matter of choice. It's not adding any extra value. Now, it won't surprise you if I say to you that Miller didn't get his Nobel Prize for drawing that little cartoon and waving his hands in the way I have. So it's a bit more formal. But we don't need to get into that. What we need is the intuition. If we were living in an M&M perfect world, we need never think about dividend policy. We might as well not bother paying a dividend. It's not going to do anything to the value of the firm. But we go back to Lintner and his observations, and his observations suggest that companies do pay dividends, at least some companies. So that sets us wondering, why might dividend policy be relevant in the real world, but not relevant in the M&M perfect world? What are the key differences between the real world and the M&M perfect world? And I've listed them here on this slide for you. Transactions costs, taxes, and information asymmetry. Now let's take them one by one. Suppose we start with an M&M perfect world and we relax one of the assumptions, namely no transactions costs. So suppose we're now in a world where the company does incur issue costs whenever it raises fresh capital from outside. I just explained to you, using my cartoon, I've just explained to you that the only way the company can increase the size of its dividends is by raising additional capital from outside. But now that there are transactions costs, if it does that, some of the capital it raises never finds its way into the company. It ends up in the pockets of the brokers and the advisors, etc. There's no way that a company would ever do this, because it's losing some value to a market friction. So I can tell you now, if we were in a world where there was a single market imperfection, namely transactions costs, no company would ever pay a dividend. Because the only way the company could sustain the dividend, and indeed enhance the dividend through time, would be to go back to the capital markets and raise additional capital to fund the increase in the dividend, and every time they did that, they'd get hit with issue costs, so some of the financing they were raising would never find its way into the company. So no company would do this. It would be suboptimal. So that deals with transactions costs. That cannot be the answer. So now we have to look at the other possibilities. The first of which is taxes. So let's learn or remind ourselves a little bit about how taxes work. So I need to remind you, what are the motives for shareholders to own shares in a company? And there are two. Investors own shares in companies for one or both of two reasons. The income they can enjoy from receiving dividends, if the company pays dividends. Not all companies pay dividends. High-tech companies, which are generally exhibiting high growth, they may be relatively young companies, typically pay little or no dividends. They want to hold on to all of the surplus cash flow for reinvestment purposes to promote further growth. You don't have to go back that many years to a point in time when Microsoft had still never paid a dividend. Microsoft now pays a dividend, but it's only done that in recent years. For most of its young life, it never paid a dividend. Likewise, companies like Sun Microsystems, Cisco, etc. Companies that are based in the world of IT. So not all companies will pay a dividend. Where the company has an established dividend paying track record, then one of the reasons why the shareholders are in the story will be to receive that income. The other reason they're in the story will be to enjoy capital gain. They're hoping, perhaps expecting, that the share price will go up through time. When they finally come to sell those shares at a gain, that's part of their return. So there are two motives: income and capital gain. And the income comes in the form of the dividends. In a perfect world with no market imperfections, watch my finger, because my finger is tracing out what the share price would do. Did you see what happened? The finger was exhibiting random fluctuations, just like we've seen during the market efficiency lecture and seminar, and then it took a dive. And what happened to cause it taking a dive was the shares paid a dividend. And the amount by which the share price dropped at that point in time is the amount of the dividend. That's in a perfect world with no taxes. There's no loss in value. It's just that the form of the value changes. So prior to the payment of the dividend, all of the value is captured in the share price. Immediately on payment of the dividend, the share price drops by the amount of the dividend per share. The shareholder doesn't lose value. His or her shareholding is still worth the same in total. The package is worth the same. The shares are not as valuable, but the amount they've shed in value is exactly the amount that the shareholder has received in the form of dividends. So he or she doesn't lose out. That's in a world where there are no taxes. Where there are taxes, income taxes to be paid on dividends, it's not true. Where there are taxes to be paid, we have to think harder about the tax-paying situation of the shareholders. Are they higher rate taxpayers or basic rate taxpayers, depending on their overall levels of income? How much do they earn from their employment, from their savings, etc.? Do they pay taxes on income at the highest rate, which in this country is 40%, or do they pay at the basic rate because their income is lower, 20%? Think about it for a minute. Investors who receive dividend income get treated differently by the taxman depending on which taxpaying, income taxpaying bracket they're in. If they're basic rate taxpayers, they pay 10% on dividend income, and that 10% is taken at source. They never see it. The dividends they receive from the company already have the 10% income tax, dividend income tax, deducted. Not so the higher rate taxpayers. Sure, the higher rate taxpayers, they also receive the dividend income with the 10% basic dividend income tax deducted. But that's not the end of the story. They have to pay additional income tax. Basic rate taxpayers get away with 10% dividend income tax. Higher rate taxpayers have to pay a total of 32.5% dividend income tax. They have to pay the taxmen additional money in the form of tax bill. They settle up with a taxman at the end of the tax year when they fill in their tax return. Can you see why investors in the higher rate taxpaying bracket might not be so keen on receiving lots of dividends? Because 32.5% of the dividend doesn't belong to them. It ends up in the hands of the taxman. So the suggestion is, perhaps higher rate taxpayers would prefer to own shares of companies that pay low dividends, possibly not any dividend. Instead, they'll prefer shares for which they expect there'll be a nice, tidy capital gain. So the suggestion is that in the real world, perhaps the world of investors, the shareholders, perhaps we can divide them into two camps, except we don't call them camps, we call them clienteles. As to whether they're higher rate income taxpayers or basic rate income taxpayers. The dividend policy will matter now, because those two types of investor will favour shares that pay quite different amounts of dividend. The higher rate taxpayers will prefer to own shares in companies that pay low or no dividend, whereas the basic rate taxpayers, they may be indifferent, the chances are they're basic rate taxpayers because they don't have so much income from other sources, including employment, so the dividend income might actually be quite useful to them. So they'll favour owning shares, to the extent they do own shares, they'll favour owning shares of companies that do pay dividends. So the suggestion is that taxes are a real-world effect that result in the dividend policy mattering, and the way it sorts itself out in the real world is the shareholder community divides into two. So the suggestion is that high dividend paying companies, those shares, the shares in those companies, will typically be owned by basic rate income taxpayers. Whereas companies whose shares pay low dividends or not any dividends will typically be owned by investors who are in the higher rate tax bracket. And that's what is observed. And what makes it feasible is the dividend policy that companies are observed to practice is one that changes slowly through time. People generally don't change tax bracket that quickly. So, someone who's a basic rate taxpayer who signs up for the shares of a company that pays relatively high dividends, the chances are they're going to stay basic rate taxpayers for quite a long time. So they'll be hoping that that company continues to pay high dividends. Likewise, the higher rate taxpayers, they will typically favour owning shares of companies that pay low or no dividends. Companies generally, we believe, we observe, companies generally try to increase the size of the dividend, but gradually over a long period of time. These higher rate taxpayers will be seriously discomfited if the shares that they bought because they were paying little or no dividends were suddenly to start paying big dividends, because that's going to mess up their tax planning. My point is that's not going to happen anytime soon, because the dividend policies that companies typically operate evolve slowly at a moderate rate. So, Lindner's observations that companies tend to operate stable dividend policies reinforces the observation that investors tend to separate into distinct tax clientels. So tax is one reason in the real world why dividend policy matters. And the way it sorts itself out is natural selection. The high income tax paying folk tend to invest in the shares of companies that pay little or no dividends. The basic rate income tax paying folk tend to invest in the shares of companies that pay high dividends. And it's a stable configuration because dividend policy only evolves gradually, not in dramatic changes. But that's not the only possible explanation as to why dividends might be important in the real world. So that's taking care of taxes. Now let's look at this assumption of perfect information. Let's relax the assumption in the M&M perfect world that everyone has the same information set. In the real world, there is private information. And the people who have private information legally are the senior managers of the company. Anyone else who has that private information may or may not be acting legally. It depends what they do with that information. So in the real world, there's an asymmetry. Not everyone knows the same information. Now, I've told you before, in the lecture on market efficiency and in the seminars that supported that lecture, I've given you, I hope, a clear impression that financial markets feed off new relevant information. The financial markets are only too aware that they never know enough. They never know as much as the senior managers of the companies. So they're always looking for clues. Clues that they can read into either the announcements that the company makes, that would be public information, or clues in what some of the financial analysts manage to glean from interviewing the senior people. And company and financial analysts make regular company visits, so there's a lot of traffic in this sense, or in the decisions that the senior managers take that can be observed. So the financial markets are always looking for clues, and the reason they're looking for clues is, one, they don't have as much information as the senior managers, and two, the investors in the financial markets, that's the shareholders and the debt holders, the lenders, are risk averse. They always fear the worst. So they always worry about, we don't know enough, we need to know more. Could the dividend be a way in which the company can talk to its shareholders without revealing too much of its hand? What do I mean by that? The decision to increase the dividend, might that be a signal to the shareholders that things are looking pretty good? The company's senior managers don't want to reveal to all and sundry what it is that lies behind their view that things are looking good. So they send a signal. Now, everyone can read the signal, but it's a way of telling the shareholders we're feeling upbeat about our future prospects. And the way we're signalling that to you is we've increased the dividend by more than you were expecting. That's good news. It's a way of telling the shareholders something without spilling the beans to everyone else as well. And that's the second reason why dividend policy may be important in the real world. The dividend itself, the announcement of the dividend, has information content. All other things being equal, the share price will respond to a surprise as regards the dividend. If the size of the dividend per share is bigger than the market was expecting, all other things equal, i.e., and if there's nothing else to complicate the story, all other things being equal, the share price will go up. Because that's a piece of good news. That's a positive surprise. If the market was expecting the dividend to go up, and the dividend per share does go up, but not by as much as the market was expecting, all other things equal, the share price will drop. Because that's a disappointment. And the company's senior managers have to manage their shareholders' expectations. So the dividend has information content. It's a signal to the shareholders. There's the second reason in the real world why dividend policy might be relevant. I've one further suggestion to make to you that distinguishes the real world from the M&M perfect world. And that takes us back to the idea of agency effects, which we met in the second of the two lectures last week on capital structure. Can I remind you? Principal agency effect. Principal agency conflict. Who are the principals? Who are the agents? The principals, that's the owners, they're the shareholders. Who are the agents? They're the senior managers. The shareholders have delegated the day-to-day running, the decision-making, to the senior managers. The senior managers act as the agents of the principals. In the theory, the senior managers are always meant to be looking for ways of maximising shareholder value. That's the theory. Can we be sure that the decisions that the senior managers make are always perfectly aligned with the best needs of the shareholders? And the answer is, not in the real world. The shareholders know that. So agency effects refer to instances where the senior managers might be tempted to make decisions that are not in the very best interests of the shareholders, possibly in their own best interests. So the shareholders need ways of monitoring the decision-making. And I told you in last week's lectures on capital structure, I told you about the role of the non-executive directors to keep an eye on the decisions that the executive directors on the main board are making. But there are also other ways in which the shareholders can effectively control the behaviour of the senior managers. And the dividend policy might be one such way of doing it. The more of its surplus cash flow that the company pays out in the form of dividends, the less so-called free cash flow that remains for the senior managers to squander, not to do the best thing with. So the dividend policy could be a self-disciplining tool. Sure, it's the senior managers who set the dividend policy. But the senior managers get re-elected to the board on a regular basis by the shareholders who have voting rights. And if enough of the shareholders are unhappy with the decision-making that the senior managers are making, they can be kicked off the board. The shareholders can call an extraordinary general meeting. They don't have to wait till the annual general meeting to do this. And the managers know that. So my third suggestion to you, as to why dividend policy might be relevant in the real world is as a self-disciplining mechanism. By paying out dividends to the shareholders, the company is retaining less free cash flow. Cash flow that the senior managers could possibly use not in the best way. And that's my final suggestion. What I didn't say to you last week, and I should have, in the context of capital structure, is debt also plays such a role. Because the more debt there is in the capital structure of a firm, the greater are the interest payments. Again, the less free cash flow that's left for the managers to invest in their pet projects, for the managers to squander in the form of perquisites like, oh, we'll have to have a company jet. Company jets are generally not in the best interests of shareholders. They're generally better uses of surplus cash flows. So one reason that I should have added to last week's capital structure lecture, the second lecture, one reason in the real world, another reason why debt might be favoured, is to reduce the amount of free cash flow left in order to control better the decision making of the senior managers. Likewise, the dividend policy. By paying out more rather than less dividends, there's less money left for the senior managers to squander.